welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Steve Montgomery, the author of The Converging Apostasy and A Quick Outline of Hands-On Eschatology, A Matter of Timing and Agency. And together, we're examining the themes of apostasy in the New Apostolic Reformation and its history. Steve, it's good to finally be back. It's been a while. And to talk about this subject today, which is going to be very fascinating for me. Up to this point, I have studied most of the things that you've talked about in the podcasts and read through your book, so I'm familiar with most of it up to this point. But when it gets into the subject today, which is the Russian themes of apostasy and Russian mysticism, it's something that just fascinates me because it's this whole other world that I have not yet tapped into. The closest I've come is, you've probably seen these videos, trying to remember the name of them, but it's a spy show and they're going into Russia and the Russians have all joined this mysterious cult and it's taken over the Kremlin and they're trying to get breakthrough. You know the story, and I'll let you explain what it is because everybody should know that history. It's kind of famous, but that's the limit of what I know towards Russian mysticism and Russian history, but it has had a huge impact on the rest of the world, more than most people realize.
Yeah, it's good to be back again also, John. One thing I can say is in the larger book, The Converging Apostasy, I have a section called From Russia with Love, and it talks about people like Alexander Dugin, who's a real problem if you read what he has to say about his life and his worldview are pretty alarming, especially with his influence on Vladimir Putin. And then one of the biggest names in that mysticism from Russia is actually Vladimir Solovyov, which we've already talked about him. So this is some similar stuff, but it's not necessarily focusing on those two guys. So even as a preliminary to that, it's just crazy how, you know, this happens, John, where you're not really looking to find out about something. And people that, you know, they say, what are you seeing there? What are you talking about? Well, this is based on a short drive in the Houston area. And if you've ever been to Houston, that's not always a short drive due to the bumper-to-bumper traffic jams that you get. And it's also a big city spread out a long ways. So in my short drive in Houston, I had these two aspects that I ran into, which is kind of like the converging apostasy, which essentially you have one from the right, that's very, very generally speaking, and one from the left, also very generally speaking. So the left would be mostly your New Age and esoteric type folks. And then the right would be anything coming out of the latter rain and tilting on into Christian identity. And so, yeah, there's many points in which these converge. But more particularly, this is what I observed when I was on the roadways in Houston. On the right, meaning on my right-hand side, and also the right religiously, politically, there was a bumper sticker on the back of a church, on the back of a truck, which said, "Keep America Great." So, okay, I kind of get the idea where that one's coming from. And on the left, there was a car, and it had a sticker on the back that says, "As above, so also below." My wife said, "What is that?" And I kind of wanted to hold back because it's an awfully big subject. But sufficient to say it's completely in the New Age, occultic, esoteric realm that you run into that phrase. And this actually led into, we haven't talked since the 4th of July, but I had some Neoplatonist leftovers that I ran into. Okay, so one, Neoplatonists, we talked about calling down angels is a big component with that belief system. So one, as I recall hearing a song, all the way back in 1984 by Amy Grant. She called it Angels. And she says pretty much basically the divine protection can at times come in the form of angels. So to quote her, she said, "God has angels watching over me. Every move I make, angels watching over me." Okay, so that's going backwards. Now, go back just to this recently big event that we had for the 4th of July. So if you happen to be watching the TV, the popular singer, I was going to say country, but she does country pop, other stuff, Trisha Yearwood, got on and sang a couple of tunes. So because of the nature of the song, and because I just can't let go, I have to dig in and find out for myself, I found out she does attend a church called Christ Church USA in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay, fine. That's good to know. But I looked at it a little bit more in particular, and they believe in, quote, the spiritual gifts, which means they speak in tongues, prophesy, and do other things, and maybe have a connection to the NAR. I don't know that. But on the online, they label themselves as a non-denominational church that teaches the fivefold ministry. Okay, John, for you, myself, and many others, we kind of see a red flag going up there with the fivefold ministry. So let's hear what Yearwood has to say about angels in her song. She had a song called Bringing the Angels, and she performed that, like I said, the 2025 4th of July celebration in New York City. So how is this different in any way from Amy Grant's song? Essentially, it's this, and this is the Neoplatonist angle. Yearwood's song puts the human will as what is engaged to call angels. So she says, direct quote here, "I'm bringing the angels. I'm calling them down." Okay, that could go from anywhere from NAR to Latter-Rain to William Branham talking like that. She then equates angels with, quote, "all them saints," a.k.a. the cloud of witnesses, which is so overemphasized by the NAR and other groups. And she says that they can be experienced through human perception. She says, quote, "I can hear them. I can feel them." Okay, so just biblically speaking, are we supposed to be calling down angels so that we can hear them and feel them? I would put my foot forward and say, no, we're not supposed to do that. I don't think she's a heretic. Seems like a great singer. But there's something out of balance here. So I would say that this is has clear Neoplatonist leanings, like those of Jane Lead, her disciples in the Lateran movement of 1948, and with the NAR prophets, Gwyn Shaw, Cindy Jacobs, Jennifer LeClaire, and Bill Hammond. My question is, which I haven't found the answer, how did this sort of idea get into Yearwood's song and evidently into her church?
Without asking her, it's difficult to know. However,
<Yeah.
clears throat> if you look at the way that the Lateran movement shifted Christianity and upended Christianity, because it really flipped it on its head, they wanted to create the notion that you needed these super apostles. It was a movement of super apostles, basically reinventing Corinthian worship. Well, if you follow that out to its logical conclusion, these super apostles then become your spiritual elders and your spiritual guides, many of which, ironically, were claiming that they had angels with them. Not just Branham did this. There were several in the movement that did this. So then what happened is people began to associate the super apostle with the angel that they claimed to be with them and started to morph the mythology until such that the angel and the human became almost one and the same. The problem is, because the focus was so shifted upon the human being and the alleged angel that's with them, they started to think of these as almost deities. Not quite, but almost. Then when they died, now they become God's generals, as you know. Well, What if these generals come back and talk to us in spirit? That wasn't that uncommon in the Latter Rain movement. So they basically took the worship of the dead saints that they condemned the Catholics for, and they brought it into Protestantism through this weird mythology. And like I said, this is developing in the United States, but in Russia, something very similar was evolving at the same time.
Yeah, you're setting this up well with the notes I have coming up here. So the main point I'm looking here is what I'm thinking of as sort of a circle of apostasy. And so I'm thinking Russian mysticism that kind of occurred in several places through several key people, but you see it very clearly in Russian Orthodoxy. Something that occurred in Russia, which is more of a history lesson, but their instability became a breeding ground for apostasy. So there's a pretty much a direct link there. So the Russian Empire became the birthplace of terrorism and political struggle between roughly 1861 and roughly 1917. And there's all kinds of historical landmarks that happened in those time frames, which we wouldn't really want to have time to go into that. So it was a government under siege by its own population. How? One, by searching ways to crush the terrorism, which was so rampant. Two, by shattering traditional views of morality and restraints against killing people. That's pretty extreme. And three, by promoting a mentality in which everything and anything is permitted. As a result, the Russian dream, you know, we hear the kind of like the American dream, make America great again. The Russian dream was born out of largely a suppressed, uneducated faction of peasants who often turned to mysticism for the answers to the problems they saw. It also grew out of something which we've seen happen here in the United States at various times. It grew out of rejection of the intellectual scholasticism of both Catholics and Protestants. So this allowed the Russian Orthodox Church to incorporate unorthodox practices. For them, it included political utopianism, and that goes into some clear political movements that we could look into, and to religious esotericism. Here's one of those rhetorical questions, but are there parallels with the Russian dream and current tendencies of instability in America?
You know, it's funny, and that leads me back to the movie that I was watching and what led to all of my curiosity in this. The movie I was mentioning was The Kingsman. I don't know if you've seen it, but it is a great, great movie, and they're talking about Rasputin. So Rasputin, yeah. Anybody who's unfamiliar with this is very much like we see with the NAR today. This is a religious entity being a cult led by Grigory Rasputin. I think I said that correctly. Yeah. And he convinces, you know, the powers that be that he has this mystical power connection to God. And I want to clarify one thing that you said. You're talking about it's through the Russian Orthodoxy. However, if you look at Russian Orthodoxy to the Russian church, to this extremism, as you do Christianity to Protestantism, to this Protestant extremism that we have, it is the extremism on both sides. The extremist cult that has the mystic views that can mystify the powers that be and take over power structures and governments, etc. You're having that happen in Russia. Well, what's interesting is the time frame of all of this, because the Russian, as this is happening, it was after this that we start to see this really becoming a push in the United States. The United States, certain devious characters wanted to take over the government, and what better way to do it than through religion? It largely failed during the early years as they're attempting to do this, but now I look at it and I have the same rhetorical question you have. Did they actually do it? Is that what's happening now?
Yeah. Yeah, John, and point well taken about to clarify, because anything you say about any of these movements or individuals, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, because there's so much more background to it. And you can't overgeneralize and say that everybody in the Russian Orthodox Orthodox churches or fanatics or something like that. That would be incorrect. But that does lead to a something that more like when you laid out the example of Protestant Lateran NAR. Okay, obviously not all Protestants are in the NAR. And then you lay out similar parallel with Russian Christians, Russian mysticism, Eastern Orthodox Christians. They're not all identical to one another. So that's a good point. So one of the points, though, that I found very interesting, and we even talked about it, and I said at the point, I forgot which video this was in, but I said, I may be shooting from the hip here, so don't quote me. And I found out I was basically correct that there was a movement in Russia, which the leader claimed to be Christ. Well, how many times we've heard that happen in different movements and religious sects? So he claimed to be Christ, and his followers, because they're persecuted so much, went from Russia to other locations. And some of them even made their way over to the United States. And so we'll get into that. And Mr. Rasputin has a little moment to shine coming up here. So one of the mystical groups that I was pretty much unaware of, except for that vague thing I was talking about, it's spelled K-H-L-Y-S-T-Y. Kliste is what they call them. So the Kliste, who were they and what were they like? Well, it so happens that a fellow named Danilo Filipovich, I'm going to have a good time with names today, claimed to be a Christ. So in 1645, he founded the Kliste religion or sect. It has been said to be the root of all Russian sectarianism. So that's a big statement, but there's some evidence to support it. Filipovich was eventually arrested for spreading so-called demonic illnesses. And so the government did not like what he was up to. His followers would beat themselves in self-flagellation to be made what they called martyrs. So if anybody's seen the movie The Da Vinci Code, 2003, there was a monk, an albino monk named Silas. And at one point in the movie, his back is exposed. He's got numerous scars from the same thing, beating yourself, quote, into submission to Christ. But incorrect way of viewing things, I would say. So this group held secret Vadinye ceremonies, and they called them times of rejoicing, vaguely similar to what we might call praise and worship service. But something interesting that you would relate to, John, is that just like William Branham, after his death, myths arose about Filipovich's resurrection and second coming.
And you go back to the Bible, it says there will be Christs and false Christs. And when you read this, you don't think that people will actually do it. Who would be stupid enough to do that? And who would have the gall to do it and call themselves Christian when the Bible so plainly says this? But you have to understand the way that these guys do it is, in many cases, they won't outright say that they are the Christ. What they will instead do is they will drop hints for you to follow, little breadcrumbs, to lead you to that conclusion. And after they've hooked enough people to believing that they are the Christ, then they can openly declare, yes, I am. Or sometimes they, like William Branham, he did the same thing. And it wasn't until the last, I want to say it was like 30 days before he died, was the only time that he ever declared it fairly publicly. And even then, he didn't come out and say, I'm the Christ. Instead, he said, the Elijah of this day is the Christ. But he had convinced his followers that he was this Elijah. So right. They leave you these breadcrumbs, and they set themselves up to be beyond the super apostle. They are the Messiah.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that I find extremely interesting, not good, but this is a question I kind of posed to myself as I was gathering information. I said to myself, how do the beliefs and practices of the Kliste compare with those of the NAR and their ideological forerunners. So here's what I came up with in my searches. Just like the 17th century mystic Jane Lee, they became known for their elitist claims to, quote, personify Christ. This was a big deal for her. She said that over and over and over in her writings. You don't necessarily hear that in the NAR, but you get pretty much the equivalent of it in how they carry out their doctrines. Like many esotericists, they say that Jesus was just one of many who became filled with the Spirit of Christ. You get that implied in some people with the NAR and some manifest Sons of God teachers, but it's even more clear in the esoteric world. They also claim that their leaders of each of their congregations, which they called arcs, as in a ship, an ark, each one of those arcs had its own Christ and its own Mother of God. So, like the Moonies, you know, you got the Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. The Cleistae would chant what they called the Jesus Prayer over and over to experience the presence of God. Now, if you've done, John, I know you've done this. I'm not sure who's listening, if they've heard about this before, but pretty much you can say anything from the Bible, from just nonsense. You can, you know, chant phrases from Buddha. And if you do it enough, you kind of zone out and you get a mild euphoric, mild hypnotic state. So they would say the Jesus Prayer over and over, and they would say, oh, it's the presence of God. Here's what they called the Jesus Prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. All right, so you can hear that's scriptural, but its use becomes the vain babblings and repetitions of the pagans, Christ inferred. Like participants of the latter rain and the NAR, prolonged fasting was promoted. As a result, they became known as the Postnica, also called the Fasters, loosely translated. This one was a bit odd. They were very extreme. Rather than submit themselves to what they saw as apostasy, leading to the advent of the Antichrist, some would actually set themselves on fire, calling this the baptism of fire. Okay, yeah, that's in scripture, but it's not meant to be carried out in that way. Also, like someone else, like the Valentinian Gnostics, they were instructed to keep their ritual secret. I wonder why. To guard this secrecy, they would be Russian Orthodox outwardly to kind of keep things cool with the public and with their fellow villagers, but they would be Cleistae inwardly.
You know, I have very little to say because I don't know much about this group. However, the arrested for spreading these demonic illnesses, it makes me think back to one of the things that Branham did in the revivals was he claimed that as his position of super prophet or super apostle, he had the ability to condemn people and in doing so give them cancers or various diseases, which he was claiming to be these were demonic possessions. So he's literally saying he can give you this if you question his authority. And people believed it. And we have an example. If you go to my website, type in the man from Windsor. There's this one guy that he says, this guy, I was passing out these prayer cards, and this guy figured out that I was having the people write the name and the address on the card, and then I was just reading the cards. So he was going to fake an illness on his card, and I struck him down, and he died right there on the platform. And then he tells the story again, and he says, and the guy ran screaming from the platform. And he tells, I mean, there's, I don't know how many variations to the story, but there's so many you can tell it clearly was made up. Otherwise, it would have stuck in his head. But he's doing the same thing. He's casting these demons. And I, you know, in this one aspect, I'm not a big fan of Russia, but in this one aspect, I think people like this should be arrested.
Yeah, I agree. Now, this this could probably be something that, because you brought up Rasputin, There are some things that if you've got some younger listeners, you might call this PG-13, some of the stuff coming up here. But the next thing I had here for this group and some other mystical groups in Russia was drunk in the spirit and the pleasures of the flesh. Somehow these two came together. So very similar to Sufi dervishes, the effect of their whirling circle dance was said to be like spiritual beer. Okay, if you think really hard about some praise and worship services, especially those that are very cult-like, spiritual beer is not too far off the mark. So after this dance where they're whirling around, the worshipers would fall to the floor. Some, at least they were said to then engage in group sinning, which they believed would purify them from the lusts of the flesh. Like the medieval brethren of the free spirit, it was through this time of sinful, quote, rejoicing that salvation could be attained. And this could only be by total repentance that was salvation to be obtained, because unless you'd sinned completely, you cannot be completely saved, was their logic on that one. And so to rejoice in this way, they met in a secret location where they so-called called down the spirit. They did this like the many modern-day people who produce the presence in the NAR. In other words, like those who participated in the Toronto blessing in 1994, the Cliste would rejoice through rhythmic movements, ecstatic dancing, speaking in tongues, or what they thought was speaking in tongues, and falling to the ground in convulsions. Oddly, they then drank kvass, which is a mild alcoholic beverage, and ate pastries. So I think they had one up on the Toronto guys. At least they got to have some pastries. So Cliste practices are brought to life further by a man named Edvard Radvinsky, and he wrote A Personal Encounter of Radinje Ritual, which was Radinje is their celebration. And he wrote this in 1964, so you can see that they were continuing on for quite some time. According to Radinsky, quote, white flaxen shirts were worn over their naked bodies as they went down to the cellar of a peasant lodge. Then they lit candles and started to chant repeatedly the Jesus prayer. They would then start the time of so-called rejoicing by whirling around in place, crossing themselves, which oddly they do a different way. I can't duplicate it, but it's different than typical Catholic would cross themselves, slightly different. And they would continually whip their bodies, as I said, you know, that flagellation thing. Some started screaming and sobbing. Then the Christ of their art cried out, "Brothers, I feel the Holy Spirit, God is within me." He then began to prophesy, shouted out incoherent words, mixed with these intelligible words, "O Spirit, O God, O Lord."
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So I hate to admit it, but you lost me at pastries. My mind went straight to that, and I'm hungry. And I'm thinking, why in all of these services that we had all of these similar things, why did they not pass out the pastries? Because then it wouldn't have been so bad. But what you said in that, I want to I want to pause just a second because I don't think people realize the implications of this. You can have the same ecstatic experiences simply by getting yourself into this mental state where you are susceptible to those those spiritual experiences, but without the pastries. You can hype yourself up and you can have a quote-unquote spiritual revelation just by getting into that mental state, that euphoria. And it really, it's a psychological technique more than it is a religious thing. However, if you're in the Pentecostal variations or the charismatic variations of Christianity, you are trained to believe that by entering that psychological state, it is a spiritual experience, and therefore anything that comes out of it is from God. The problem and the question that's raised is when you can do it without having anything to do with Jesus or Christianity, you could go with your blueberry pastries and have the same experience. Can you really say that that blueberry pastry gave you a heavenly experience? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it would have to be a strawberry pastry, actually, to make it work. But no, that's a good point, John. So what always comes up in my mind when I'm looking at these things is who influenced the Cliste. Okay, I didn't take too much searching until I found somebody who influenced Jane Lead, who's probably one of the central people of the entire occult world, who influenced Helena Blavatsky and even Satanists like Aleister Crowley look at this guy and say, oh yeah, he was really something. And that is the German mystic Jacob Boehm, or Jacob Boehm. So he had a very significant influence on some other Russian mystics, but this included the Cliste. And to be more specific, Boehm's ideas were brought to Russia in the 17th century. What a busy time that was spiritually. By a fella who I probably got to mispronounce his first name, Kiernis Kuhlman. And Kuhlman traveled to Moscow and began to spread Boehm's mystical revelations. In 1669, at the age of 18, Kuhlman said that he had a vision of Jesus. Well, when did he have this vision of Jesus? It was directly after reading Boehm's work called The Mysterium Magnum. Kuhlman's followers believed that he would bring in the new millennium. This is kind of a mouthful here, but I'll try to break it down where it's easy to understand. Similar to Norfolk, who are following this urge to take dominion, to, you know, establish the seven mountains and then carry out the written judgments of God. Similar to that, Kuhlman said that his goal was to have Protestants and Ottomans join forces to destroy Catholic Europe and the Pope in order to establish the kingdom of Jesus. Well, unfortunately for Kuhlman, he was tortured and burned at the stake for heresy in 1689.
So like I said, Steve, you're going outside of my research a bit, and my brain is crying squirrel. First, you mentioned pastries, and my head went there. Well, you started talking about drinking, drunk in the spirit, and the squirrel that hit me at that point was this lady that is known as Hatchet Granny. I don't know if you know this story, but there was a lady literally nicknamed, elderly lady nicknamed Hatchet Granny. Her name was Carrie Nation, and she would go into the bars and the saloons during Prohibition with a hatchet, a literal hatchet, and just smash all of the beer and whiskey. And the funny part is you mentioned the circles that are happening here. So you have circles where people go into ecstasy and they can augment it by drinking and they assume this is a spiritual thing, which obviously it's not. Well, then it goes into these weird circles where any form of ecstasy is bad because we've seen the bad on this side. Now let's go to the far extreme to the other side where we're literally smashing property with a hatchet. And then it'll swing back again to in the NAR. I had a conversation earlier today where the leaders of the NAR are getting exposed for their drunken parties, and some of them are in religions where you're not supposed to drink in their frame of mind. So it keeps going in these weird circles that spins. But in the end, what you're saying is correct. people find ways to get into the spirit of ecstasy, and you find some bozo who is just nutty enough to say, I have a religion about this ecstasy, and I'm going to teach you how this brings you closer to God, but you need to get there through me.
Yeah, and you know what? There's an expert that I'm sure you've read about his findings about this sort of stuff in religious cults. What we said when I got out of the group I was in, what was very apparent was you could believe literally anything, but if you went through these certain processes and ways to, get your mind in this altered state of consciousness, you'd subscribe that to the belief system, which is wrong, it's backwards. So we'd have this joke about, actually there was a religious cult. Actually, it was kind of thumbing their nose at religious cults, and they called it the Church of Bob. All praise Bob, and yada yada, blah blah blah. Then they would do certain things to get them, quote, in the spirit of Bob. And, they would hyperventilate, fall on the ground, and say all these odd things. But the fellow that I know, I heard him once in a YouTube interview saying that he could take somebody, because he's a psychologist, they could take somebody and through a few suggestions make them see a bright shining light. And he was not a mystical guy. He was not highly religious, but he just knew the right mental manipulations to demonstrate how easily and how possible it is to get folks to experience whatever you want them to. And then that becomes the proof that the group they're in and the teachings and revelations are, quote, of God. So like a lot of these groups, the Kaliste suffered a lot of persecution. Throughout their history, this came pretty much from the government, sometimes from other religions, other factions, the Orthodox Church. And this actually pushed them to migrate from Russia to Romania. That's the part that I'd remembered saying something about that in a previous podcast. And yep, the influential Russian Orthodox mystic Grigory Rasputin was investigated in 1903 and in 1907 under the charges of spreading Kaliste doctrine. Okay, like that was a bad thing. The government didn't like that. He was never found guilty, but the rumors about this linked to him and the sect continued.
And like I said earlier, that's the history that I saw in a movie, but I had heard the history before the movie, so I knew it existed. But it wasn't until watching the movie that I began to piece together the links between the types of religion that I left and the types of the religion that take over the governments. And I started to recognize, wait a minute, they are one and the same. If you can bring anybody's mind into this spiritual state where they're in such a state of euphoria that they don't question you, you can do anything. I mean, you can conquer the world like this. So I'm watching Rasputin do this in a movie, which is, you know, parts of the movie weren't quite historically accurate, and I knew some of that history. But the part that's interesting, the part that they went to the extremes with, they were augmenting the power of this religion to such an extent that I think that they were trying to over-exaggerate it, but even missed the mark as to the level of control that actually can be achieved through these things. And I'm going, all that is in my head, and I'm processing and realizing that we're in a dangerous place in the country today, because we're seeing exactly that, but under the name of Christianity in the United States.
Yeah, point well taken on that. That's very accurate. The thing I was thinking when you were saying that is I pretty much remember when my son was at the age of watching various Disney movies animated, there must have been something that I saw where it was about the influence of Rasputin on Russian nobility. But he was, again, probably historically inaccurate to a large degree. Here's another one, is that his name still comes up this way. They say that that in the same way that Steve Bannon influenced Trump, in the same way that Dugin, I mean, Alexander Dugin, influences Vladimir Putin, they call Dugin, I've heard him compared to the Rasputin of Vladimir Putin, which is not a good thing. Yeah. So now we get to something that is very interesting that caught my ear, and it makes me want to learn more. But I found out about these Sons of Freedom. The Sons of Freedom were an offshoot of the Kleiste, so it's offshoot of an offshoot, which I know you've said that many times, John. They splinter, they go into different groups, and sometimes maintain a lot of the original stuff, but other times become really distinct. So this is interesting. With the financial support of the Russian Orthodox author Leo Tolstoy, around 7,500 of the Sons of Freedom fled persecution, moving to Canada between 1898 and 1903. So if you look into Tolstoy, of course, War and Peace and the many novels that he was famous for, he was interesting in that he was Orthodox in a sense, and I think he might have been excommunicated at one point because his views were so contrary to the Orthodox Church. So the Sons of Freedom rejected all forms of state interference, such as compulsory education in government schools and the use of tax money for the military. Oddly, they would protest these policies through arson and public nudity. How that helped their cause, I'm not really sure. Interestingly, during 1947 and 1948, the Sons of Freedom performed many acts of arson and nudity in Saskatchewan. I know Saskatchewan is a big place, but it was the birthplace, so to speak, of the Latter Rain movement. Then in 1953, 174 of their children were forcibly detained by the government. This led to more violent confrontations between the Sons of Freedom and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And I can't help but see something about Dudley Do-Right in my head every time I say that. In total, the Sons of Freedom committed 1,112 separate acts of arson. This cost the government over $20 million in damages to public schools, and they seem to like to hit railway bridges. Now, here's the thought that could be a bit controversial, but it really hits me strong. Like, kind of like you said, we're in a dangerous spot. How do these extreme forms of protest relate to current day unlawful detentions and the denial of civil liberties?
And that's really a hard question. You know, you mentioned the public nudity. There's, I don't know if you're familiar with this group, but there is this music group called the Bare Naked Ladies. And I've seen Christian people just go berserk when they see the title. Just because the title has that word in it, they go right. Crazy. However, if you're walking down the street and you're not of that fundamentalist mindset, and here's a sign that says, Bare Naked Ladies, $5, come listen.
Yeah.
It attracted all kinds of people. It was actually a brilliant marketing strategy, if you think about what they did. But take that to levels weirder in the Christianity. In Latter Rain, there was this man by the name of Moses David Berg, which you're probably familiar with. He was attracting members to his cult through sex. He would send these people out, and they were called, what did they call them? The happy hookers for Jesus. They had flashy
hookers for Jesus.
Flashy fishers. Different names that they gave these ladies, but that's what they were doing. They were prostituting themselves. And he was commissioned by God to be ordained as this minister, whatever it was that he claimed, by William Branham. Not many people recognize that. But Branham is the one who started him, and he got extradited, or not extradited, but he almost got caught, and he moved out of the country, and he started producing these very almost X-rated magazines and comic books. And in the comic books, it's weird because he's got all of this very, very pornographic literature and material combined with praises of William Branham. And one of his cult escapees sent me this. Where I'm headed with all of this is, also mixed in with that is Christian identity, because the roots of this was all Christian identity. And if you follow those roots out to their extremes, you have the same thing. You have the rioting, you have the damage of property, you have all of this weirdness. And it was being presented to the people as a religion, as a fundamentalist. One of the other articles of research that I had up recently was the Defenders of the Christian Faith. It was a fundamentalist organization, institution founded for the fighting of evolution and the spread of Christian identity. And there were men, famous men, like Charles Fuller of the Fuller Theological Seminary, from which C. Peter Wagner was, you know, gained his fame. He was a member of the Defenders, so he's in all of this. You can't say that Fuller and the Fuller Theological Seminary are extremists to the level of violence, but they're in a movement that is, and that movement is tied to religion. So you have levels of extreme, and all of this extremism is branching off of the main sect of Christianity. So these extreme sects are very dangerous.
Yeah, the part about the racial components with Moses David Berg, you call himself. He actually, I imagine you probably saw this, but he would use and promote the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the learned Elders of Zion. And obviously, if you know about that text, he was using that to excoriate Jews. He also had some comments about blacks and the entire race that can only be called racist. But the pamphlets you're talking about, I'd like to be able to unsee those. But when I was helping to counsel people out of the Children of God, one of the bits of information we got a hold of, the materials, to understand the group and know, okay, this is what they've been accustomed to. They were called Mo letters. And yeah, they would say Hookers for Jesus, and they would say Flirty Fish. So you go flirty fishing, and this was apparently to use any means possible, including sexuality and sexual favors, to get people into the group. And they actually had something that runs really parallel to the Moonies. The Moonies would say heavenly deception. So you can tell the world anything. Tell them, yeah, you're raising money for Christian rehab or for homeless children, and in fact it's going straight to Reverend Moon and his organization. Well, the Children of God had a similar idea, and some people, ex-members of the group that I met, they said they used this phrase. They called the world, people in the world, were systemites. So you could lie to him, steal, do whatever you want, and you were not beholden to act by any Christian standards, because they, the world, were obviously not of Christ. They're of the devil. Therefore, that means you can use the devil's tactics to get what was stolen from the church, from his version of Christianity. So, yeah, terrible, terrible group. Another thing that's that came a little bit more current day. Mysticism in Russian Orthodox Church was what they called Inocentism. And this was a Christian charismatic group that split off from the Russian Orthodox Church. They were active in both the Soviet Union and in Romania in the early 20th century. They were followers of a guy named Ioan Levizor, who took on the monastic name of Innocente, a.k.a. the Heavenly Emperor. Okay, that's what it basically translates to. Levizor claimed to have heard a voice tell him, the time has come, hurry up. 3 days later, he said he saw the Mother of God. In order to hurry up, he preached that the Antichrist would soon appear in Russia. Are Christians today being told to hurry up at the expense of sound doctrine?
And with that, I would say absolutely. We see that fear is probably the strongest tie that binds people to the cult. There's this fear of urgency. There's this fear that the Antichrist is coming. I grew up with this fear. The Antichrist had set up its kingdom in various places, depending on which sermon you listen to. There's a little bit of conflict there. But in the end, they were coming to invade the United States, which ultimately was the Christian identity doctrine. They were saying that they're coming into the United States. They would soon set up our kingdom here. So we were taught to be afraid of this happening, and that fear binds people. And there's always that hint of urgency. If you can add a hint of urgency to whatever is your platform, they're like, oh my gosh, I must hurry. I must make the decision. I must stay. And that's what binds it all together.
Okay, so more about Levizor and his followers is this. They believed that he was the Holy Spirit in human form. And based on that belief, they claimed that he could do many miracles. Levizor would allegedly ascend to heaven every evening as one of the miracles he would perform. Like William Branham and many other false prophets, Levizor set a date for the end of the world. This is a problem when somebody does that, because it's hard to backtrack it, you know, as many groups have found out. He stated that the world would end on April the 12th, 1913. This led him to ban all marriages and to praise free love as a gift for the New Jerusalem. In 1914, according to his followers, Levizor was captured and subjected to the most horrifying tortures. For 40 days, he was chained, crowned, and with thorns on his head, and made to sit naked on broken glass. That's in their account. Levizor's followers were subjected to Stalin's Great Purge, which was basically from 1936 to 1938. This Great Purge included anarchist nuns who were executed for so-called committing crimes against the state. So, as we know in history, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, a lot of folks, Hitler, would claim that people were committing crimes against the state, and therefore lock them up, throw away the key, or go ahead and execute them. Then in 1947, 10 anarchist leaders were sent to Joseph Stalin's corrective labor camps, aka the Gulag system, which is essentially like Hitler's concentration camps. But they gave it a euphemistic name, that maybe like they've got bad karma if you're talking New Age. We're just going to send you to a corrective labor camp. No, this is not punishment. We'll take good care of you. So anyway, that's what happened to the leaders of that group.
And the only interesting comment that I have for that, which is, it's a little bit out there, but not many people are aware of this. William Branham worked closely with a Congressman William D. Upshaw, who was the head of the Prohibition movement. Upshaw was also a leader in the Klan and defended the Klan in Washington. Well, Upshaw joined into the Latter Rain movement, and he was a strong promoter of Branham's ministries. Right across the river in Louisville, Kentucky, there's a history museum, and they, for a while, they had this big section of William D. Upshaw and how William Branham had healed him right in this museum in Louisville. Well, I can't remember what year it was, sometime in the 50s, the Latter Rain guys sent this letter to Joseph Stalin, and William Branham's signature was on it. He talks about it on recording, how they were trying to, I guess, convert Stalin during his last days of his ministry, or last days of his empire. Where it gets really odd is there's a period of time in which everybody in the United States is so strongly against Russia and communism, and they think that it is the Antichrist that's spreading throughout the movement. Branham himself did the same thing. But in the moments when they're trying to convert him, Branham condemns anybody who says that Stalin is the Antichrist. He says those two spirits will be so close they'll deceive the very elect if possible. It's not Stalin. And then later he changes his tune because apparently Stalin never converted to Latter Rain.
Yeah. It's a crazy world. Now, I can tell you, John, just whatever your schedule looks good for it. This, as always happens, unlocked the door to a lot of other stuff. And it's probably something if you'd like to do it in the future. There's pretty much a part two to the Russian mysticism, and just a lot of fascinating folks, and
Absolutely.
some of them have some actual real ties to folks in the Latter Rain, or folks that influenced the Latter Rain. So like John Portage, there's a big connection between him and some of the Russian mystics. So
Well, thank you so much for doing this, Steve.
I enjoyed it, John.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about the Converging Apostasy, you can read the book The Converging Apostasy, and also A Quick Outline on Hands-on Eschatology, A Matter of Timing and Agency.